afternoon, good evening, and good morning, Power Hour Nation. It is 9/7/2018, wherever, whenever you are listening. Welcome. So good to be with you. I'm your honored host, Daniel Brigman, and you are listening to the Power Hour radio show, thepowerhour.com, thepowerhour.com. Great broadcast, chock full, feel good Friday. Richard Gage, of course, our friends from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He's going to come on for a little bit on the second hour, discuss the program for 9/11 there in, I think it's in Washington. He's got two of them going on, or New York. He's here in New York and Washington. He's still got that bill that we're working on. We'll discuss that. Tom Palladino about scalar energy. We'll learn something about that. Our first guest, though, who's waiting on the line right now, is someone new to the Power Hour. We're very happy to meet him and introduce him. His name is Michael Hart. He has a radio show called The Michael Hart Radio Show, michaelhartshow.com, Hart, H-A-R-T, michaelhartshow.com. And he's written a book called Unknown America, Myths and Little Known Oddities About the Greatest Nation on Earth. Very interesting. Very glad to have him on. Michael, welcome to the Power Hour.
Well, thank you for having me, Daniel. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. We've never had you on before. Tell us a little bit. You do a show. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you even came to write this book.
Well, as you pointed out, I do a program that originates out of Birmingham, Alabama on 101.1 FM. And, you know, we're heard in several different markets down here. It's a political show. We also deal with current events, what's going on in the media, and things of that nature. And being here in the Deep South, you know, we're always dealing with issues of culture. Of course, you know, obviously the national anthem, Nike police brutality stories that are a real hot-button issue for us. But some years ago, I was doing some research for a segment that I was going to do for Black History Month, which, of course, is in February, 5 or 6 years ago. And I discovered some interesting facts about the story of Rosa Parks and how much of that story had been revised throughout history, and that Rosa Parks obviously was not the very first woman to ever refuse to give up a bus seat in Montgomery, Alabama, and uncovered the story of a young lady by the name of Claudette Colvin. Well, that kind of got me interested in just looking around and seeing what other factual revisions there might have been to American history. And as I got deeper into it, I discovered one after the other, after the other, after the other, and essentially completely ruined about 7 or 8 years of my American history classes as I had to deprogram myself of so much of what's taught in our classrooms. And that was kind of the impetus. And then, of course, that gave way to, you know, discovering some other oddities and little-known facts about this country. And that gave birth to the first volume of the book, or the second, the third, in the very near future.
Unknown America is the name of the book, and I think that's fitting. Unknown America. You know, most of these reading here, I was going through, I would say 85-90%, I never even heard of. A few of them I did, but just really interesting things. Why don't you tell us some of the things that startled you or some of the things that surprised you while writing?
Well, you know, there's just a lot of, like I said, not only revisionist history, but, you know, we hear the Trump administration primarily talk about the advent of a fake news. And although, you know, President Trump, you know, is right to a degree about that, the media has been culpable in crafting a narrative in this country for many, many, many decades, if not centuries. And some of the things that we discovered, for example, was that, you know, Betsy Ross did not sew the first flag, despite the fact we're all taught that. As a matter of fact, the Betsy Ross story doesn't even make its way into history until about 1870, when her grandson is interviewed for a newspaper out of New York, actually a couple different newspapers, and he's promoting this idea that his grandmother sewed the very first flag. And then you have to remember, at that point in time, there's no mass manufacturing mechanisms in the country at all, so they would have had multiple seamstresses. There are no writings in the early days of Jefferson or Washington or Adams even reference Betsy Ross, and the simple fact of the matter is that she doesn't appear in any of the history books pre-1870. Now, she did exist. She was a seamstress, but we don't have any idea who sewed the first flag. But we've got all these depictions of her with the woolen cloth draped across her knee, you know, sewing the stars and bars together, and that event never happened. Another one that didn't happen is the signing of the Declaration of Independence. First off, America didn't declare her independence on the 4th of July. It was on the 2nd of July, and we know that for a fact from some writings from John Adams at the time. But when the Declaration of Independence was signed, the very first person to sign it was John Hancock. He signed a blank piece of paper, and for a couple of different reasons. Number one, the Declaration had yet to be transcribed. And also, at that point in time, they weren't certain. You got to bear in mind, had these guys been found out during the 1700s, if they'd been found out, they would have been hung. They would have been executed almost immediately. So John Hancock was actually alone. There was only one other person even in the building at this point in time. Then the signers began to come in days and weeks later. The declaration wasn't even completed being signing until we know at least late August, possibly as late as November that year. So all these depictions of all these old white wig guys standing around a desk signing the Declaration of Independence simply didn't go down that way. And most of the depictions that are in most of the portraits and the depictions that are out there are actually portrayals of them much later in their political career. But that event never occurred either. And it's just another one of those things. And it doesn't diminish anything to do with American history. But so much of it has been depicted in so many manners and revised and homogenized and even glorified in certain positions that never even occurred.
You also wrote about a lot Samuel Adams, you know, the beer company now, we know him. You clarify Samuel Adams, what was he really like?
Well, you know, Samuel Adams, first off, he never brewed beer. Now, his dad owned a malt house, and this was a place that would have broken down the wheat. And when you make beer, the basis for it is called wort, W-E-R-T. And the brewers would use this wort, and you can buy it. Some people homebrew these days. But he actually owned a company, the father, that created the mixture that would become beer, and then he sold that to brewers. And then when he died, Sam Adams actually inherited the company, ran it into the ground, and so he goes out of business. Now all of a sudden he's unemployed. But Sam Adams was very skinny. He was a particularly articulate speaker, but he wasn't a real attractive guy. Some people even said that his skin was gray, and he wasn't a very imposing figure. Now he was oftentimes called upon by some of the early founders as the person that would address some of these conventions because he was such an articulate speaker. But the guy that you see on the bottles of Sam Adams, that's actually Paul Revere. So, again, if you like a Sam Adams beer, and I ain't drinking anything that's even remotely patriotic.
Tell us, well, maybe that's a lesson for everybody. You don't have to be this, imposing figure with a booming voice or whatever to be an influencer because Samuel Adams was called the father of our revolution, with those limitations.
Well,
tell us a little bit about.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, a lot of founding fathers, we have marbleized them. A lot of people don't realize that the Library of Congress, the original books that formed the Library of Congress, those were once belonged to Thomas Jefferson. And the Congress decides to buy the books from Thomas Jefferson to help him pay for his barn hat. At that point in time, adjusted for inflation, as they say, Thomas Jefferson threw parties that sometimes ran as much as $900 a day in today's money. So you've got all these guys out there that are, they're drinking, they're partying, they're doing their thing. The whole time they were doing the Revolutionary War, Benjamin Franklin, he's over in France trying to raise funds for the war effort. In the meantime, he's also chasing skirt while Mrs. Franklin's back here in the United States of America laying on her deathbed. I'll tell you something else that we discovered that didn't make it into volume one, but we'll make it into volume number two, is a couple of founding fathers referenced a party that took place when the declaration was being we say it's July 4th when we declared our independence, but apparently 2 days before the Declaration of Independence was declared, or the actual independence of Great Britain was declared, this massive party breaks out. We even put the liquor list in the book. This massive party breaks out, and if you take the timeline of when we declared our independence and when this party was actually conducted, when they met for the convention, it's highly possible that the framers declared America's independence while they were completely toasted. So there are just all these little things, about American history, because they all love the party, they all love the dance, and they were just like every human. We look at these stodgy old gray-haired guys. You had signers that were in their 20s. A lot of them were the millennials of their day. So they are so misunderstood on so many different levels.
Well, you might be drunk, too, if you knew you were signing your death warrant. Maybe you get drunk also.
Absolutely, and people don't realize that. They would have been hung, drawn, quartered, and hung a second time. These guys were pretty brave, but they were that just kind of underscores, you know, how bad they wanted to get away from King George. But, you know, at the end of the day, if people really understood what colonial America was like at that period of time, it was hard stuff. It was hardcore stuff, and it was raucous. You know, back when they're doing the Constitutional Convention, I mean, that might as well have been the North Korean Parliament meeting. You know, there's guns going off, the tables flying. It was rough stuff.
Tell us a little bit. Thomas Jefferson's been linked to, having a child with one of his slaves, Harriet Hemings. Tell a little story about that. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, you know, Harriet was his daughter. And what's interesting about Harriet Hemings is reportedly she was quite beautiful, but she was also what they sometimes refer to as passing. In other words, she had white skin as opposed to her brothers that were a little darker skinned. And Thomas Jefferson, a lot of people don't realize this about him, he actually ruled all his children when they turned 21 years of age. So he would give them a few bucks and send them on their way. But one of the things that he told his daughter before she left was, do not ever tell anybody. Because despite the fact that some of the reporting about, you know, culture and race relations from that time has been a little bit on the revised side, it was absolutely a harsh time for African Americans, as you can well imagine. So Jefferson dispatches her out into the world with the instructions, do not ever admit who you are. By the way, we get this story from one of her brothers in one of his writings. She has some money. She goes out into the world, and she actually marries a white businessman who has – she fathers or rather gives birth to a federal – of his children, obviously, lives her entire life without anybody ever knowing who she was, and it wasn't until after her passing that her brother came out and told her story that we've learned about it. But Jefferson loved his children, all of them, no matter where they came from, but yet he was very adamant about telling Harriet Hemings, if you admit to anybody out in the world that you are my daughter, your life will be significantly different, it'll be significantly more brutal. She didn't, she thrived in life, and that's one of those stories that just kind of falls to the wayside.
We're going to a break. We have a short segment coming up. Maybe any other founding fathers or the colonial times story, maybe think of that. We'll bring that up. Then we'll go forward. Man, this book is full of all kind of state facts, quirky things. I mean, this is a cool book. Stay tuned. Michael Hart, Unknown America is the book. Myths and Little Known Oddities about the Greatest Nation on Earth. The website is MichaelHartShow.com, Michael Hart Show, that's H-A-R-T, MichaelHartShow.com. Michael Hart has a radio broadcast there in Alabama, right in the heart of Dixie. I grew up in Georgia, so we're almost cousins, Michael, so this is good. Absolutely. To hear somebody with a southern accent on the show. Unknown America. Yes, very good. Short segment here, any other... things about the founding fathers you may want to bring up, or early American heroes or what have you?
Well, you know, again, there's a lot of really, really quacky stuff out there. And just to kind of give some bullet points, and again, point out the website where folks can get the book. But, you know, we've already had, for example, our very first gay president, and we've also had a female president. And those are some things that some people will discover in the book. Another one of my favorites.
Well, tell us.
Well, tell us. I can't just leave it hanging out there?
No.
You heard the very first gay president was actually James Buchanan. And, you know, of course, he was the president before Abraham Lincoln. He's the only president that remained a bachelor his entire life. As a matter of fact, you know, we were talking during the break about Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson, at one point in time, began referring to him, a guy by the name of William R. King, that was a senator from Alabama. And he used to refer to them, Jackson referred to them as Aunt Nancy and Miss Fancy. And it was well known in those circles. And Buchanan never married in his life. Matter of fact, his niece was America's, what they call it, first hostess. And I know we're getting tight on time, but in the book, we've even included some of the love letters between James Buchanan and Bill King from the state of Alabama. The men lived together. And a lot of folks were not aware of that. And so, yes, you know, although Buchanan never came out of the closet, the belief at that time, and Andrew Jackson was that very supportive of this belief, was the fact that he was, in fact, our first gay president. And some of these letters are rather telling. And in some more Andrew Jackson trivia, you know, he was Old Hickory, the big Indian killer and whatnot. Right here in the state of Alabama, he was fighting Indians at Horseshoe Bend. One of his lieutenants found a young Indian boy crying in a field. brought the young boy to Andrew Jackson. Jackson looks at the lieutenant and says, I don't know what to do with him. Take him to Mrs. Jackson. She'll know what to do. And Andrew Jackson actually raised that Indian boy. His name was Lincoya. Raised him to adulthood. Now, he died in his early, late teens, 17, 18 years of age. But Andrew Jackson actually raised this Indian orphan as his own son and even put him through school and gave him the best life he possibly could. So that's just a little softer side of Andrew Jackson. But almost every one of our early founders and early presidents has some kind of story that's just absolutely beyond amazing.
I also read in here about, especially in Louisiana, the bride brigades, marrying for love, arranged marriages. I thought that was pretty, that was a little different. Talk about that real quick.
Oh, yeah, there was all kinds of things. And even the bundling bag they used to have back in that time. A lot of people don't realize that when, during colonial times in particular, when a young girl went to the altar, got married, the numbers varied between 28% and 31% of brides that got married at that point in time actually were pregnant when they went to the altar because of this thing called the practice of bundling bags, where they would make these young people actually, you know, cohabitate over the evening for the purposes of getting to know each other. But then you look at things like the casket girls and the pelican girls from Louisiana, because as the country was developing out, there was all this westward movement and all these men that were building the railroads and the shipyards and all that stuff, and they would literally import women into, you know, these areas to marry off these men because they understood that the family was the backbone of the country. Well, you can't have a family if you ain't got a mama. So, you know, they're bringing women in from France and from England, and some of them were a little questionable in terms of their reputations. But in Louisiana, for example, if one of your relatives was a casket girl, and a casket girl refers to the cases or the suitcases, the trunks that they would carry when they came to America to marry men that were building the fucking.
Very interesting. You say you have to have a mama to have a family? Well, that's a very biased idea here nowadays, Michael.
If it's out there, I realize it's extreme, but that's what they're telling me.
I thought that, you know, in God We Trust, you tell a little story about the First Continental Congress Act, one of the first acts. We had another guest wrote a book about that. But your logic in this, I thought, was just perfect. When somebody says our founding fathers weren't Christians, they were deists, what would you say?
Well, you know, some of them were deists, but it is interesting to note that even the deists at that point in time voted for In God We Trust. And it's even in the fourth verse, I'm sorry, of the Star Spangled Banner. So even Francis Scott Key wrote it in there. And, you know, the Christians, they wanted, you know, even the deists thought that religion should be taught in our courthouses and our schools and the public square. And it is kind of weird that I come in the book. I don't know if they really were closet Christians, if they were just hedging their bets. But one thing about them at that period of time, they understood all too well that there was a supreme being.
We're talking now very happily to Michael Hart. The book is Unknown America, Myths and Little Known Oddities About the Greatest Nation on Earth. Michael, we were talking about, you were ending up on a story about Andrew Jackson and the Founding Fathers and deists and prayer. Do you want to go ahead and finish that real quick?
Well, you know, what we talk about, Dan, it was just the fact that, you know, the country, you know, was obviously founded on Christian principles, and so many of them, and a couple of them were even atheists in their writings, and, you know, and we've learned that, but all of them understood that the underpinnings of society is dependent upon the belief in a supreme being, and even those that were devout deists at their time, you know, there's been debate as to who those were, but so many of them had advanced idea, Jefferson, Washington, Adams, all the early presidents, many of the early founders, that religion as a supreme creator must absolutely be acknowledged. And the fact of In God We Trust and an acknowledgement of prayer was the very first thing, as you point out, the convention that Congress actually voted on as the first official act in America. And then they allowed it up to the individuals to make the decisions. Bear in mind, you know, at the time of the colonies, almost every one of the colonies was founded as a form of a religious enclave. Right? In your home state of Georgia, that's where the Baptists went. You got the Dutch, the Pennsylvania Dutch. In Maryland, my original home state, that's where the Catholics camped out. So, I mean, almost every one of the colonies had a religious underpinning to it, and that right there is evidence that a lot of this was freedom of religion, freedom from oppression from England, And, you know, we can talk all day long about what the founders actually believed, but their actions tell the story that religious liberty was at the underpinning of their viewpoints. And then you bring economics into it after that, and that's how we get the foundation of America.
I didn't know about slavery, that there were 12 million, roughly, a little over, Africans shipped to the New World, but hardly any of those, percentage-wise, actually came to North America, came to the United States. I did not understand. I didn't know that. Maybe discuss that for a second.
You know, the slavery thing is so interesting, because that entire narrative is, I'm not going to say that it's been, you know, overblown, but there's a lot of things that are just not known about it. And the overwhelming majority of slaves that were brought to the New World ended up in South America, but even the majority of them actually ended up in Brazil. And this is something where we could talk about this for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours if you wanted to, because there's all this, you know, kneeling conversation going on and national anthem conversation going on and Nike and Kaepernick and all this kind of stuff. That's one of the things that's got people like me a little amped up, because, you know, it was in 1807 that Thomas Jefferson outlawed slavery in the New World, and that's where you get slave runners from, you know, after the fact. And so you've got, you know, the founding fathers, they knew slavery was not illegal. It wasn't a legal condition in America at that time. It just was, there was no laws against it. And so you've got all this narrative out there where people don't realize that there were blacks. There was, I think it was 3,000 families, black families, in Louisiana alone that owned slaves. The very first legal slave in America was actually a black guy. It was a guy by the name of Anthony Johnson. He owned a slave by the name of John Cassar, who sued for the right because it was more of an indentured servitude kind of a thing at that period of time, which gave birth to what the southern states would eventually do with slavery. And again, we can go into this for hours on end if you wanted to, and it's just not the... It doesn't diminish the brutality of slavery, but the reality of it is there's a lot that's unknown. There's even one slave by the name of Elizabeth Freeman, and her name is actually, her slave name was Mom Beck. She sued for her freedom in a colonial court and won. And so it was not unusual at that point in time for some blacks to actually learn their legal rights and to utilize them in a court of law. You even had one plantation outside of Baton Rouge that had 157 slaves that was actually owned by a black woman and her son. And so the whole slavery narrative, although it's very factual in a lot of respects, there's a lot of unknowns about it as well.
Well, let's talk about this headless chicken. I thought that was one of the most quirky, interesting things I'd ever heard. Tell us about this headless chicken.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. Is a lot of people have questioned me about, you know, my sourcing and things of that nature. And I've researched and resourced this book, you know, five different ways from Sunday. And, you know, I used the Smithsonian Institute and the folks over at History.com and the White House, you name it. I have sourced and cross-referenced so many of the historical claims that I make in the book, and they're all factual as I presented them. But the one that really befuddled me the most was Mike the Chicken. And, you know, there's even a website out there that supports this, and it apparently really did happen. If you think about it, it kind of makes sense. But it was actually, it was not the chicken that lived without a head. This happened in the 1940s in Colorado. This farmer, his name is Lloyd, and his wife Clara were actually killing chickens on a little farm in Fruita, Colorado. And one of the birds that they chopped his head off, when they woke up the next day to go in and start plucking feathers, the bird was still alive. Now, according to his son-in-law, and this is a quote, by the way, they get down to the end, and one that was still alive and up walking around. The headless chicken kicked and ran and didn't stop. It was placed in a box on the farm's back screen porch. And again, when they woke up the next day, the darn thing, he used the other word, the darn thing was still alive. And it lived for 18 months. And essentially, what, as we understood, when they cut the chicken's head off, there's a certain, don't force me to get into the medical explanation of this, but apparently there's a part of the brain that is at the very base of the cerebral cortex that allows you to breathe, your heart to continue beating, et cetera. And they missed that part of the brain. So for the next 18 months, and there are pictures of this chicken on the internet, by the way, for the next 18 months, they fed Mike the Chicken down his neck with an eyedropper.
I also heard that they took it to carnivals or fairs or whatever, and actually made a pretty good living off that chicken.
Absolutely. You thought the bearded lady was the profit center? Can you imagine having the Mike the Headless Chicken walking around? I swear, I shook this story upside down so many different ways. But, you know, I actually used to raise chickens because, you know, I'm in Alabama, but that's kind of a haul here. I've never killed one, at least not intentionally. I ran into one with a tractor once. But, you know, I'm reading this story, and I'm just thinking to myself, there's just no way. But, yeah, apparently there's even a Mike the Headless Chicken convention up there. It's the darndest.
If you like history, quirky things, trivial facts, and not so trivial facts too, if you like, this is the book for you on America. Any other quirky stories like that you'd like to bring up before I start asking you some other things? What else struck you?
Well, there were several of them. You know, like the state of Colorado one time, you know, had three governors in a single day. You know, that was basically a matter of one guy. There was accusations from both sides of the fence about voter fraud, and so the courts get involved in it, and they take the election away from the guy that won it, and then they gave it over to the opposing side for 24 hours under the pretense and the requirement that at the end of the day he retired, and then the Supreme Court appointed the third governor in the state of Colorado. It's kind of a lengthy story, but it just kind of underscores, you know, the political climate in the country at that point in time. But as you point out, you know, the story about Sacagawea is completely wrong. Adam Doubleday did not invent baseball. We've got documents that have baseball being played in America 30 years before Doubleday is even born. You know, there's just so many things about, you know, colonial marriages and you know, they didn't name children in America for the first 2 years because the mortality rates were so unbelievably high. We've got information there about the Titanic and a book called The Wreck of the Titan, which is eerily similar to The Wreck of the Titan, or the Titanic, rather. Of course, the Liberty Bell, everybody thinks the Liberty Bell cracked when, you know, they rang it in Independence Square in Philadelphia, ringing in Liberty. But that was forged with that crack already in it. We didn't really know how bad it was. But there's a story after story after story. One of my favorite in there is about how Apple computer, you know, that Apple, actually how they came up with the Apple insignia with the bite taken out of it. I found that to be a fascinating story after story after story in the book, just like that.
He told me during the break, theunknownamerica.com, theunknownamerica.com, where you can buy it there. You get a free copy of the Declaration of Independence. I want everybody to have that. Great. Man after our own heart. Fantastic. Michael, is there, so your audience in Alabama there, one of the most perplexing questions that's driving myself and half our audience about loony is Jeff Sessions. He's from Alabama. What in the world is going on with Jeff Sessions and Trump? What is he doing?
Well, you know, Daniel, I wish we knew. You know, Sessions as a senator here was very, very, very popular. I've had him on my program multiple times in the past. And, you know, I was actually down in Mobile, Alabama, some years ago when Trump declared his presidency. Sessions was with him. Sessions did not endorse him at that time, but was on stage with him. We all thought here in the state of Alabama that Sessions certainly would. And when he did, we knew he'd get some kind of, you know, lofty position in the Trump administration. We never thought it would be head of the DOJ. But, you know, when he went off to serve in the Trump administration, we kind of fashioned him as Alabama's Trey Gowdy. He might not be as confrontational as Gowdy, but he certainly holds a lot of the same viewpoints. A lot of folks know where he comes down on immigration. And so we expected him to be a real bulldog for, you know, what we consider to be our Christian conservative values here. And when he recused himself, you know, with the Russian investigation, he hasn't gone after an indictment of any of the co-conspirators, so to speak. He hasn't gotten rid of Mueller. There's a lot of disappointment here in the state of Alabama over his performance and, you know, his willingness to defend the president. And although it's not necessarily the attorney general's, you know, exact job to be the president's bodyguard, certainly standing, you know, behind him and supporting him in the face of what's obviously ginned up charges as it relates to Vladimir Putin, we felt like he would be, you know, the state motto in the state of Alabama is we dare defend our rights. And there's a lot of pride in this part of the country. And we really expected Sessions to go up there and kick a little, if you know what I mean. And he has been very feckless and tepid in his response, and about half the state of Alabama is very unhappy with it.
Do you think he is going to be replaced? Do you think he's going to resign? What do you think the future holds?
Our belief here locally is the day after the midterms, if the House and the Senate are secured, he's gone the next day.
Something needs to be done now. I mean, does your audience get the feeling like Trump is a bird on a wire and just people are taking pot shots at him with BB guns all day or what?
Yeah, you know, we do, but we also knew, you know, when Trump was talking about draining the swamp and going after the deep state, I mean, if anybody that's familiar with history, and that's one of the reasons we wrote this book, you know, recalls being old enough to recall Jack Kennedy's subversion speech, where Jack Kennedy, many people think that he lost his life in Dallas because he was standing up against what he perceived to be the deep state at that point in time. So we knew here, particularly, you know, in Alabama, with Sessions going up there, that Trump was going to be on the receiving end of things of this nature. So we're not quite as worked up about it as you know, some folks might be. It's a disappointment, but we knew there was going to have to be some eggs and some heads that were going to be cracked. The thing that frustrates us is the willingness of the media to jump all over. It's just like when Cory Booker came out yesterday, he's screaming he's going to release these emails that was going to reveal Kavanaugh as a bigot or a racist with a racial profiling. Those emails turned out to be absolutely nothing. They were already declassified, but yet CNN has turned him into some kind of folk hero for releasing declassified emails that everybody else had already read. That's stuff that frustrates us here locally.
What do they have on Jeff Sessions that made him recuse? I mean, he seems like he's being blackmailed. I mean, am I making up things? I mean, it seems perplexing.
We've pondered that down here as well. We don't know that they have anything on him as much as he's just trying to be. I don't know if he's responding to the Loretta Lynch era, Eric Holder era, or if he's just, you know, when you're in the Senate, you know, you've got the cover of all the other senators that agree with you. But when you're standing alone as Attorney General, all of your decisions are yours to own. And I just think we're getting a sense that Jeff Sessions had the courageousness when he's in a group. But, you know, it's just like if you take a look at the sea, you know, when a shark is coming, they always try to separate that porpoise from the herd. And once he was separated out and he's out there on his own, he just didn't be quite as courageous as we interpreted him to be while he was in the Senate.
What do people in Alabama think about this whole kneeling NFL issue, Nike now coming out? What's their opinion?
Well, you know, I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and Birmingham has the largest Veterans Day parade in the United States of America. We are completely awash in military bases. As you are well aware, Georgia was or is as well, the Florida Panhandle, because you and I are from the same basic neighborhood. So you can imagine what the undertones here are in terms of the veterans. In addition to that, being in Alabama, you got to bear in mind something else here. Alabama, you know, unlike Georgia, you know, Atlanta specifically, we don't have an NFL team here. We're Auburn fans out. SEC country. So we are automatically suspicious of anything NFL-wise anyway. The NFL is not a particularly popular sport in Alabama because the city has felt like it's been shunned over the years. And we're in Atlanta. We can't support an NFL team. We kind of honestly have that kind of predisposition to be suspicious of people that we consider to be, you know they're wealthy, they're overpaid, the whole nine yards. But so, you know, being antithetical to the anthem. I mean, the anthem of all things. If Colin Kaepernick ever read the national anthem, listened to it in its entirety, you know, when this country was founded, Daniel, they founded this country knowing full well slavery was going to be a short-term deal. That's why they abolished the slave trade in 1807. And the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were written in a way that they knew that there was work to be done, that we had to aspire to the better angels of our nature that Abraham Lincoln commonly referred to. So were we perfect the day we founded it or declared our independence? No. But they knew that there was going to have to be things done. And the national anthem, which didn't even become the anthem until decades and decades later, it's a celebration of knowing that we're going to grow and become a nation that encompasses all things. When they said all men are created equal, what do you think? They didn't know slaves existed? Of course they did. But they were not saying that all men are created equal. Now, all men are created equal, and this is a viewpoint that we aspire to fully achieve. And anytime the national anthem, that's making a derogatory statement towards the founding fathers of their understanding that there was a need for change and how hard they worked and the lives that were lost to advance the opportunity for the Colin Kaepernicks to kneel in the first place.
We got about 30 seconds, a minute. Anything conclusion you'd like to say? Unknown America is the book, theunamerica.com. Michael Hart, it's very nice to meet you. The last little bit's yours, my friend.
Well, you know, I just want people to understand that if you don't understand what's going on in the world around you today, it's great to have a lack of history, you know, of American history. I realize there's a lot of fun things in the book. The book is funny, it's cute, it's nice, it's entertaining and informative. But the world makes a whole lot more sense if you understand that there are things that we've gone through in this country in the past that we're going through today. Just, you know, there's nothing new about the new world order. We've been dealing with it for 200 years now. Learn your history, learn your history, and for heaven's sake, please make sure the kids know it as well, because the solutions of the future reside in the past. That's why I'm proud to say it, Daniel. There's a lot of past. People need to know it.
Very good. Well, God bless you, Michael. So nice to meet you.